Welcome back to the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. This is Subscriber Exclusive Saturday, or Subscriber Saturday Exclusive, or the Exclusive Subscriber Saturday, or I know, I'll stop. Anyway, this is just for the subscribers of the Life 2.0 podcast. So if you're listening to this, that means what? You plunk down $20 a month. That's $5 a week, 66 cents a day. So you could have access to some of this more exclusive things that I do here on the show, especially interviews like this one. I am just can't wait for you to hear this conversation I had with Dr. William Forshin. He's the New York Times bestselling author of the 1 Second After series. We're going to be talking about his latest and greatest book. It's already a New York Times bestseller. It's called 48 Hours. And while I would normally don't do these type of interviews, I mean, I used to do them all the time when I was on terrestrial radio, but I'm far more selective when I'm doing the Life 2.0 podcast. I don't want to just do interviews to do interviews, right? So I want to have some sort of backing and substance and some sort of connectivity to the work that I think is important, or at least the themes that I think are important when I do these shows. So when the pitch came, that's what we call it behind the scenes. You get a pitch. I'm the catcher. They throw it. They're the pitcher. So there's a pitch coming my way about this book. And I went through it a couple times. I could see where the connecting points were. And if you listen to this show with any regularity, even if you're an irregular person, you can listen regularly. You know that there's an environmental stuff runs through a lot of what I do. And I'm all about some sort of shift in consciousness, which is, allows us to see things in a far more different way than we do if we're just walking around, you know, in half a coma most of the time. So the big hook for me, these catastrophic solar storms, they've already happened. This isn't something that Bruce Willis can fix in 90 minutes. You know what I'm saying? So in 1859, there was an event like this. In the big scheme of things, back in 1859, you know, till present day is nothing. It's not even a sneeze in the history of the planet that's 4.65 billion years old. But there was this solar storm in 1859. It was known as the Carrington event. We'll get into all that a little bit later. It was a powerful geomagnetic storm during a solar cycle that went from 1855 to 1867. A solar coronal mass ejection, CME, hit Earth's magnetosphere. We're going back to science class on a Saturday and introduce one of the most massive geomagnetic storms on record in September 1st and 2nd, as I mentioned back in 1859. So that's part of what this book's all about. And if it was some far off, really, you know, off the shelf kind of thing that I couldn't wrap my mind around, probably wouldn't be doing this interview. But that pulled me in because it's already happened. One of the major challenges we have as human beings is we have two Achilles heels. One is denial, and the other is apathy. And so looking at how this book unfolds and some of the pretense that it talks about, if an event like this happens again in the 21st century with knocking out all our technology, would we be at each other's throats or would we help each other up? Pretty important questions to ask. Anyway, because this is based on what goes in and around the sun, basically a yellow dwarf star that has kept life on Earth thriving and growing and moving forward for better or for worse for a very, very long time. There's a great website called space-facts.com. It has all this cool stuff on here. And you're going to hear me refer to it. I've already done it once about fifth grade science. I am convinced if you paid attention in fifth grade to science and you see how things are going on with the environment now and the influence that humans have on it and the impact that humans have on it, everything from taking 100 million sharks out of the water every year and what that does to the ocean's ecosystem, to the collapse of bee colonies, to, you know, oil in the water where it doesn't belong, and air pollution, and 9,000 other things. If you look at it from a fifth grade science perspective, it's kind of hard to deny that we have an impact on the planet. Most people look at it in one scenario, climate change. But there's a lot of things we're doing to the planet that keep things off kilter. And here's just a few sun facts before we get into 48 Hours with Bill Forshin. 1 million Earths could fit inside the sun. Is that not freaking fascinating? It is to me. The sun contains 99.8% of the mass in the entire solar system. The mass of the sun is approximately 330,000 times greater than that of the planet we live on. It's almost three quarters hydrogen, whilst most of the remaining mass is helium. The sun is almost a perfect sphere. The temperature inside that sphere, the sun, can reach 15 million degrees Celsius. If it was a little bit closer, we'd be up shit creek in a big way. Eventually, the sun will consume the Earth. When all the hydrogen has burned, the sun will continue for about 130 million more years, burning helium, which time it will expand to the point that it will engulf Mercury and Venus and the Earth. It'll be a big suck for anything that's still left. At that stage, it would become a red giant star. I don't know who's going to be around to decide that. Certainly not me. One day, get this, one day the sun will be about the size of planet Earth. After the red giant phase, 15 million years after it burns out, which has got another 4.65 billion to go, the sun will collapse, retaining its enormous mass, but containing the approximate volume of our planet. When this happens, it will become a white dwarf. No offense to any dwarves listening. I'm just telling you what they wrote. This, to me, is probably the most fascinating sun factoid of the whole thing. Light from the sun takes 8 minutes to reach the Earth. With a mean average distance of 150 million kilometers from Earth, and with light traveling at 300,000 kilometers per second, dividing one by the other gives us an approximate value or time of 500 seconds or 8 minutes and 20 seconds. But this is the kicker. Although this energy reaches the Earth in a few minutes, it will already have taken millions of years to travel from the sun's core to the surface. Is that not incredible? So this light that we're feeling right now, and it's a sunny day here in Chicago, beautiful day. We take the sun for granted because it's just always kind of been hanging there, burning away, doing its thing. The sun that I'm feeling now and that you're feeling now or you're seeing now has taken 8 minutes to get from the surface of the sun to the Earth. But it's taken millions of years to get from the core of the sun to the surface so it can come our way. It's fascinating to me. The sun is about 4.5 billion years old. It's already burned off half of its store of hydrogen, has enough left to continue to burn hydrogen for another 5 billion years. So, you know, we're probably okay for a little while unless we really screw things up. And finally, here was the you know, going back to fifth grade, I got to get some fun into this thing. When it looks at the top of the website, you get facts about Mars. You get, as I mentioned, facts about Earth, which is pretty cool. Mercury facts, Venus facts, Saturn facts, and of course, facts about Uranus. But I'm not going to go on that page. I'm just going to leave things the way that they are. So, with 48 hours, William Forshin, highly regarded expert on EMP, which is electromagnetic pulse, and CPE events with specializations in military history and the history of technology, has written a valid and realistic account in a fictional setting that expertly paints a picture of humanity's reaction to cataclysmic events. As I mentioned, he's New York Times bestselling author of the 1 Second After series. He has a PhD in history from Purdue with specializations in military history and the history of technology. He has made numerous appearances on Fox, ABC, CBS, NBC. He is currently a faculty fellow and professor of history at Montreat College near Asheville, North Carolina, and he took time out of his day to spend it with us on the Life 2.0 podcast. So I was reading this book. It's called 48 Hours. It was phenomenal to me. And as many of you know who listen to this podcast in all corners of the planet, and even though the planet is round, there are corners here and there, so you get my drift. But this book, 48 Hours, really begs some serious questions. So just get this. The countdown is on. In less than 48 hours, the Earth will be struck by two back-to-back catastrophic solar storms. These explosions will also severely damage the world's electrical, electronic infrastructure. In a preemptive move to avoid permanent damage, global communications are shut down. You think losing power for an hour is bad? Try that. Hospital emergency generators are disconnected. The entire internet, are you kidding? It would be the end of the world right there. Media broadcasting and cell phones turned off. A full-scale plan is in place to ensure survival after the CPE until something far more frightening is discovered by NASA's solar observation teams. And I mentioned on the way in, Dr. William Forshin is a highly regarded expert in EMP and CPE events. His latest book is called 48 Hours. It's a fantastic read. He joins me this afternoon. Bill, good to have you on the show.
Pleasure being with you.
Full disclosure, we were talking off the air a little bit. This stuff normally does not grab me. As long as Bruce Willis is in the movie and he can save the world, you can do it in 90 minutes. Why would I sit down and read a book? However, I could not put this down. And there's a couple of reasons for that. But the first thing I want to start with is, and as I said, you know, this is listed as fiction. This is something that is you know, kind of in a land of an alternate reality or something like that. But the truth is that there, and because of your background, so much of what's going on in our world today and so many things that have already happened in our world years ago really is the foundation of your work in this book.
Well, how that all happened was, I have to go backwards 15 years. I was writing mainly historical fiction and also history.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a meeting with Newt Gingrich, a good friend of mine, on a particular day in July 2004, when the congressional report on the threat of EMP, electromagnetic pulse, first came out. Newt was furious because nobody paid attention.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was on the other side of Capitol Hill because it was the same day that the report on 9/11 was released.
Oh, yeah.
Then we talked. We didn't talk history at all that day. We talked about EMP. He finally urged me and sent me over to meet the head of the commission, congressional committee, to consider writing a novel. Novels are a very, very effective way to get across truth, that doing it as straight factual becomes technical and boring.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you read the congressional report. Yeah, it's an interesting read, but it's technical. Not many people are going to pick it up.
Right.
So across 5 years, I first worked on the books on EMP. First one is One Second After.
Right.
And then after that, after I wrapped up that trilogy, my publisher kept saying, we want more. And it was a bit like that famous line with Godfather, where Michael Corleone says, every time I try to get out, they pull me back in. You know, this is kind of depressing stuff to work with at times, people.
I imagine.
But also, a line from Godfather, they made me an offer I couldn't refuse.
Nice.
So, I agreed to, well, gosh, it's over two, I think it was going on almost 3 years ago. I agreed to write a book on CME. That stands for coronal mass ejection, which is a solar storm that erupts out of sunspot. If it strikes our magnetosphere, that wonderful magnetic blanket that protects the Earth.
And we're going to come back to that, but keep going.
Yeah, it can set up a serious disturbance that could actually peel the magnetosphere back. And the penetration of various types of radiation through would blow out our electrical grid.
Right.
So I worked on that, and I felt like I was being derivative. You know, my EMP books are set in after the event.
Right.
The CME book would be before the event, but what new can I communicate? If we had 2 days' warning, everybody would be running around screaming and shouting. We could expect bureaucrats to screw things up. you had to have your hero and everything else. And then it finally hit me. When researching that, I came across something obscure called a CPE, coronal proton eruption.
Mm-hmm.
That is, to use another set of initials, if we were ever hit by a CPE in a particular sequence, it would be an ELE, meaning extinction level event.
Correct.
It could pretty well wipe out most life on this planet. That became my story.
Yeah.
First, the CME hits us, and as we're dealing with that, our main character who works with NASA goes, oh, my God, there's a CPE coming in behind this, and we have about 2 days to get ready. That, therefore, is the title, 48 Hours.
So
that's how all that started.
Yeah, so your hero in this, and you know, this is where these things really got interesting to me. So I went back, and I say this quite often. For the most part, obviously, there are things that have been improved on in science and technology, obviously. But so much of what steers my rudder now, I kind of learned in fifth grade science. And I went, I know this word magnetosphere. Where did I hear that before? And I went all the way back in my mind to Mrs. Shea's fifth grade class at Belden Grammar School in Chicago. Oh, I really did. And I thought,
oh, yeah, we all remember our grammar school teacher.
Right. And I thought, so much of this stuff I already know. So it's one thing to know it, but it's another thing to write about it in a way that brings it alive for people. And I am 100% with you. Because when you're trying to make sense out of something that's senseless, you have to use a story almost. And that's where I started getting drawn more into more to 48 Hours. Because the truth of the matter is that what you just talked about, and I'm going to ask you to explain that, maybe as good as Mrs. Shea did back in fifth grade, Bill, the magnetosphere. Mm-hmm. That is something that is truly, I think you wrote it, is like the helmet that keeps us intact from totally being obliterated. And it's something that I haven't thought of since 19, none of your business.
It is, some people refer to it as God's blanket.
Mm.
The Earth, with its iron core, is a giant magnet. It's created a magnetic field around the Earth that deflects the type of radiation coming off the sun that, if exposed to, would prove fatal. Now, a CME will disrupt that magnetosphere. It won't kill us, but it will disrupt it. But if a CPE with a different type of energy level comes in right behind and the magnetosphere is peeled back, we're goners.
Wow. Just let that sink in.
Yeah.
Because we're really stuck between two magnets is what you're saying.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. So I don't know anybody, especially since fifth grade, that I've thought, I forgot about all that, some basic foundational science stuff. We're basically a species stuck between two magnets with no say-so in how the inner core or God's blanket really is functioning. At any, it's kind of scary. No wonder these books sell, Bill.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like you're wandering around and you sit down on a subway. Hey, how you doing today? Well, I'm thinking about the magnetosphere today. Yeah, well, so am I.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Do you talk more about some reality show?
I know.
Than the stuff that's really, you know, serious.
We have a lot of ground to cover, but I want to try and put these things in as they come up in my mind. And you're a teacher by trade as well. You've taught history and military. So when you write a book like this and you throw a word out like magnetosphere, are you hoping a bunch of people like me who haven't heard it from since fifth grade take notice?
Yes.
Ah.
I try to put in a clear, simple explanation. That's the hard part, is weaving the technology stuff in while keeping the interest up the way we have with a novel. So I have my characters, they're doing their thing, and in conversations, weaving back and forth, readers pick up what is a CME and then also what is a CPE versus reading an article in Science Magazine.
Right. Yeah.
So which has a magnificent readership.
Oh, sure.
Maybe 50,000 people. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me about, because here's where this starts tying in again. And everybody knows who I'm talking to, because they, once you turn it into a podcast, you really can't get out. But in case some weird reason you lost power and you have to come back in, we're talking to Dr. William Forshin. His book is called 48 Hours, New York Times bestselling author. This, depending on who you ask, it could be the latest and the greatest of your works. And part of it for me is because I can see the tie-ins to real life events that are put in a fictional sense to get people like me to pay attention. Tell me about our hero, Mr. Carrington. How did that happen, Doc?
He's actually named after the British solar astronomer, 1859, who was observing the sun and actually photographing it, first person to do so, observed a storm erupting on the surface of the sun. It was so intense that people on Earth could actually see it right at sunset, that it looked like something was going on. Then 2 days later, boom, the Victorian internet blows out, meaning telegraphy.
Mm-hmm.
For the first time, that's a way of realizing there's a correlation between what happens on the sun and disruption of our new technology. So it was on everybody's mind for a while, and then they repaired the telegraphy system within a week or two and back to normal. Well, we've gone 150 years since then. You look at the overbuilt technology of 1859,
mm-hmm.
You know, the copper wires, the batteries, and all that. Compare that to the sensitive equipment we have today that links us all together. It's all highly vulnerable.
Oh, yeah.
A sudden electrical surge. So that's the scary part of this. We have built a remarkable technological world, the most advanced, you know, in history, and yet a natural phenomena or a military attack would take it all down.
Not 10 minutes before we started doing this interview, my internet went out. That's the end of the world for a fellow like, well, for all of us. If the internet goes down, we're up, you know what, creek with no paddle. And to me, that tells me two things. One is, as you mentioned, the vulnerability. You know, I'm here in Chicago. It's a beautiful sunny day. It's not windy out. There's no, quote, any natural disaster going on to knock it out. It came back on shortly, but you realize in little things like that, number one is it is vulnerable. Number two, how adaptive we become or dependent we become on things like that, mm-hmm. which even enhances in the wrong direction the message of your book. Because one of the profound things I got of this was that, you know, sometimes here's how I look at it. When you squeeze oranges, you get orange juice. When you squeeze tomatoes, you get tomato juice. And when you squeeze humans, all kind of shit comes out.
That's your podcast. You can say that.
That's right. Bill, if you want to say shit, go ahead. I say it all the time. But listen. But what's happening, I think, is technology for, you know, unsocial media in so many ways is squeezing people together. We're seeing what comes out when humans get squeezed. And to imagine the scenario that you present in 48 hours would be almost beyond squeezing. And I think part of the subliminal message I got out of this is, how are we going to treat each other when that happens?
That was the pleasure and the challenge. I shouldn't say pleasure. That was the challenge of writing 48 hours. You see, when I first started out, the book was only going to be about a CME, non-fatal event, but the grid goes down. How are we going to react to that? Well, when I hit on the idea, I read an article that CPE, my God, there's my story, that the event could literally annihilate most life on Earth. And I kept going around and I was asking people, if we all knew collectively that all of us were going to be gone in 48 hours, what would you do?
Yep.
The answer was almost the same for every single person. I want to be with my family. I want to be with my loved ones. Well, yeah, okay. There'd be 5% of the population wants to run amok. But most of us just want to be with the ones we love. It didn't feel like quite a story to me until I was out in Missouri last year to tape an interview. And I have good friends out there who actually are heads of security for this big firm. And I was lamenting to them, I can't seem to get this story together. What would you guys do? And the woman on the team said, I'd go underground in Springfield. And I said, what do you mean? She said, underneath Springfield, Missouri, there's something like 3 million square feet of a cavern about 200 feet down. That was a huge limestone quarry. For about 50 years, and government regulations and everything, they shut it down. And some smart guys bought the whole thing to turn it into a warehouse. No
really?
Tornadoes, no weather, constant temperature of 57 degrees a year. It's a perfect warehouse. And Kraft Foods owns 500,000 there. And I suddenly went, oh my gosh, there's the story.
So it's like a puzzle coming together for you.
Yeah, it always is. And that was, in fact, I sat there stunned, and I was like, oh, my God, I can see now. And then the producer for the show said, it's time for you to come out. I was like, no, give me 5 minutes. I got to take some notes.
Yeah.
Now, we'll add in another couple of initials, CG. That stands for continuity of government. Ever since the introduction of nuclear weapons, starting with the federal government, started digging very, very deep shelters.
Sure.
It's said that Eisenhower was inspired in part because of the Fuhrer bunker.
Really?
He was down so deep, no matter what they dropped on Berlin, it wasn't going to get him. Well, they start carving out a mountain in Pennsylvania, right next to Gettysburg.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, other facilities, the NORAD facility in Colorado Springs, state governors all wanted one, even mayors of city. I wouldn't be surprised that the mayor of your city has a nice deep shelter 200 feet down. So But they're built on the premise, primarily for nuclear war.
Right.
That if the stuff's going to hit the fan, they got 15 minutes to get into those shelters before it all blows.
Hmm.
In fact, there's a very good story, true story. First couple of weeks Ronald Reagan was in office, he's getting all the briefings they give a new president.
Right.
And they bring in different people. Well, they brought in the guy that was responsible for emergency evacuation for the personnel in Washington, D.C. And he's going on, Mr. President, if the stuff hits the fan, there'll be a helicopter on the South Lawn. We'll pull you. We'll evacuate you up to Raven Rock. Da 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 da. And Reagan just looked at him and said, okay, do it. He's like, what do you mean, Mr. President? He said, well, we're not going to get any forewarning. The Russians aren't going to tell us 5 days in advance we're going to nuke you. It's going to be a surprise attack. So, surprise. We've just picked up the nuclear weapons on radar. Get me out of here.
Huh.
15 minutes later, he was still waiting for the helicopter.
Oh, boy. Not good.
Well, that's all called CG, continuity of government.
Right.
All these shelters built all around the country. But here's the main plot point in the book. All those shelters are premised on 15 to 30-minute warning at most. But suppose instead there was a 2-day warning beforehand. Might not quite a few citizens suddenly ask, why is it that you guys get to go into the shelter?
Right. Oh, sure.
You know, with your staff and your girlfriends and everything else while we sit up here and fry.
Right.
And that becomes the story.
Yeah. And so I'm reading this. And by the way, we're talking about the new book out by Dr. William Forshin is called 48 Hours. Solar storms are basically wreaking havoc with our tiny little blue ball that hangs in space. And when I was reading this, after I started making notes, and I'll get back to some of the technical stuff in a minute, but I had to go back and pull up notes that I took probably 4 years ago on the sun itself and all the different amazing facts about this star that basically keeps us alive and can be our demise at the same time. And I'm reading this thinking again, you know, right now, and that's what's, I guess, the most profound part of this without being too redundant, is that this really is about human nature. That other stuff is nature outside of our control. Whether a solar flare or these things take place, that's not in our control. And humans don't respond real well to pressure. So all what you just said there about, you know, the haves and the have-nots are going to be split up again. It could wreak some serious havoc on top of the havoc that's already coming in 48 hours.
Yeah. The
now,
shock.
I was going to say it now. If that's not an uplifting scenario, I don't know what is.
Yeah. At 3 points in the book, I wrote what I call a vignette. You know, you have the standard times Roman typeface.
Listen.
And there are 3 parts of the book that go italicized.
And I have all those marked because that was one of my next questions. What? I've never seen that before. I'm not that well read in a lot of this stuff as far as the fiction novels and things, but I stopped and went, what is he doing here? And it made me pay attention, which was a little bit different text and theme to some degree than the rest of the book. So go ahead.
Actually, the book Earth Abides, written in the 1940s, the author did that as well. That's where I got the idea.
Well, you got me on that one.
I've never seen another book that did it. I wanted to pull the camera back away from my 4 or 5 main characters and what's going on around the world as people are reacting to this. And yes, many people are trying to get to their family. A scene, it caught me as I thought of it. A mob is storming a convenience store to steal everything they could. And in one convenience store, the guy gets shot, all right? And the other one, the guy who owns it, breaks out laughing. I'm going home. Have it. Go ahead, take everything. I'm
right.
Going home.
Right. Let me just jump in here because I didn't highlight. I would never highlight it in someone else's book, but I blocked this page out. Let me just share, well, if I may, your words with people listening, okay? Every person must eventually face their own mortality, and many try to avoid dwelling upon that until the moment is near at hand. Even then, for most, it is viewed as an abstract. Quote, someday I'm going to die. end quote, not a true reality of I'm going to die today. For nearly all, that moment of mortality is usually faced alone, or at least with the idea of quietly slipping away with a beloved family and friends to comfort, and to comfort them in return. For nearly all, there is a source of inner peace that comes with the belief that something of you goes on even if death is indeed the final ending. If not personal immortality, at least children and grandchildren or lives that you have touched will remember you after you're gone and be thankful that you had shaped their lives for the better. There is even some source of comfort with the thought of a tearful memorial service filled with words of love and thankfulness that you've been a part of their lives that will continue on. And for some, the thought was expressed by a bard 1,000 years ago who wrote that at least what remains behind is the memory of glory once won. That's pretty good shit, Bill.
Thank you.
That I read that those two paragraphs, and in contrast and context to what you're writing about, we only got a certain amount of time, I thought he's given a larger message here. Because the truth of the matter is, solar storms notwithstanding, the world ends for somebody every single day. We just don't look at it that way. Somehow we think we're outside of that because we're not in the obits today, you know?
I can't explain where those vignettes came from. I have moments when I'm writing that, let's say I put down 1,000, 1,500 words, and I sit back to take a break to reread what I wrote, and it's like, where the hell did that come from?
Yeah, I get you.
That wasn't even in my brain when I got up this morning to face another day of writing. It's really weird, and most writers I know, really good ones, they have such moments. And if it hits me in a book, I know the book is going somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It does not, necessarily hit with every book. There was something autobiographical a little bit further in where some people are stealing Lamborghinis.
Yeah.
And I talk about how some pilots go down to their airport, roll their plane out, and point it upward to see just how high they can go, and to quote from the very famous poem, to reach out and touch the face of God. Mm. That's in the poem Long High Flight.
Right.
That's actually what I would do.
Really?
I own a World War II recon bird.
No
kidding.
Original
plane. And I've had it up to 10,000 feet, which is slightly unnerving.
I was going to say, you got a little shaking going on up there at 10,000 feet?
Yeah. You are starting to feel a little bit the oxygen depletion. And they warn you at about 10,000. By law, my plane can only go to 10,000 feet.
Right.
And yet, to point the nose up and see how much further I could go. And then, yeah, I have some people in the story, they throw the plane into a spin and they end it. No, that plane, I'll put back in the hangar and pray that someday a survivor years and years hence finds and goes, wow, I'd like to fix that thing up and fly it.
There you go. Well, that is a question that started to creep into my mind. My kids are in two different states and I have family around, and, we're not as connected as a society as we used to be for a lot of different reasons.
Right.
In so many ways. I we're connected through internet, and, if I watch one more TV commercial, that you can flip up in a little box and talk to someone far away, that's fine, but it doesn't replace sitting at the table or being with those you love and everything you wrote about in the book. And I started to think about that, and then I started to think about the other part of it is, again, the bigger message for me, you're giving us 48 hours. Some people got 36 minutes, right? I mean, we don't know when our time is up. And then that spoke to me about not just how we would live when an event like this, or should an event like this take place again, like it much more challenging than it did in 1859, but how do we live now anyway, knowing that it could happen? Isn't that part of this too?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the first interviews I did on this, as I wrote this book, I was angry.
Really?
I'm angry at my fellow Americans that we are so intent now on dividing off into two warring camps that everybody on the one side is a flaming idiot or a part of anatomy I'm not going to mention, or we're all geniuses, all right? And you see the social divide that's happening. I mean, it's breaking friendships. People are screaming at each other. Just the release the other day of the report. Celebration on one side, rage on the other side. That really makes me angry.
Let me ask you this. I'm glad you brought this up, because you're a professor of history, so you spend more time in yesterday, I mean a lot of yesterdays, than most people think about, and you've done a lot around the Civil War, true?
Yes.
Okay. So when somebody says, and I'd like to just get your take on this, so you made an accurate statement that we are at this chasm in the 21st century, and that, you know, somebody who's 40 years old or 30 years old says, you know, I've never seen it this bad before. And I'm thinking, well, that's because you weren't here in 68. And that's because you weren't here in this year or when Vietnam was going on. But when you go rolling all the way back to the Civil War, even though it was a different time, I watched a couple of interviews. You made a great point about, you know, that one of the most divisive times in our lives had Abraham Lincoln at the helm. And boy, did he take some shit. They all do. So when you, I know you can't compare, like, because of technology and society, but as a people, you know, we're experiencing this divide now, but there have been times in our history we've been so far apart that we never thought we'd come back together, and we have. Are you hopeful that we can come back together again?
Yeah, I'm always optimistic. There's an old saying, God looks out for drunks, fools, and the United States of America, so I'm covered on all points. We seem to get to the edge of the abyss and we get pulled back. And yeah. A quick illustrated story of 1860. One of the great heroes in the Civil War on the Union side was Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, commander of the 20th Maine, that held Little Round Top at the Battle of Gettysburg. Wounded five times, received the Medal of Honor, was actually nominated for a second Medal of Honor. He was a college professor. Of all things, he was also a minister. And after the war, he became president of Bowdoin College. He wrote about how in 1860, he was at some sort of meeting or event, and one of his old buddies from undergraduate days is there, who's a professor at UV, University of Virginia.
Right.
They, you know, you think about it, you go to a reunion or something, you see somebody who's a good buddy in college, you haven't seen since, you get together, hey, what's going on, how's the family, blah, blah, blah. Well, Chamberlain wrote how the two of them started to talk, and within 15 minutes, they were screaming at each other, and people had to get between the two of them. It got that close to taking a slug. And Chamberlain wrote afterwards, he said, you know, in reflection, if two well-educated men like us, who are devout Christians, and be ready to tear each other apart, we're heading to a civil war. He wrote that a year before the war. And yet he was also instrumental in the reconciliation at the end of the war.
I think that for the most part, whether people admit it or not, there's an old saying that I could throw your way. You know, everybody's a self-made person, but only successful people admit it, right? And so people who are not successful, it's always somebody else's fault. However, I've always felt that, you know, we have this constant yin and yang going on inside of us. The Native Americans talk about white wolf, black wolf, and the black wolf is all the bad things inside of us, our lesser nature, and the white wolf is our higher nature, and they're fighting all the time, and the one you feed the most is the one you see the most. And so when I look at the constant bombardment of news we can't possibly use, I'm in the media and I can't watch this stuff. And it's gotten worse and worse over the years because there's so many more channels and whatever. And so there's no way to get away from it. It's like our central nervous system is bombarded into submission. So we become apathetic or pissed off. It's just one of two things. And I think there's just more to life than that. Then add to all of that, these other things that you're talking about in the book, 40 Hours, that this isn't like, you know, the Twilight Zone here. This is something that could really happen. We're at the mercy of this incredible star that basically allows life on Earth to survive. And yet, like you said, we're sitting here doing the woulda, coulda, shuffle and majoring in minor things.
Yes. Well, just in relationship to what you were saying just before that, I just saw an article a couple of days ago that off Miami Beach, they now have this like 300-foot barge with a humongous television screen on it.
No.
And it's a quarter mile offshore and throws advertising at the people on the beach. Great. And the guy who thought it up gives the usual BS answer. Well, it's a new way of communicating. Yeah. A lot of people actually enjoy it. Yeah. You're right. We can't escape. I did manage to escape several times. I'm fascinated with Mongolia. And almost 20 years ago now, I went over on a couple of archaeological digs for a couple of summers and a couple of one summer and one autumn where my buddy and I went over, got on horses, and just explored.
Wow.
Totally disconnected from everything for 3 weeks.
What was the big aha off that? How great was that, right?
It was aha. It really was. You're out there in an environment that hasn't changed in thousands of years with a culture. It was the last sort of gasp of the nomadic culture. It's pretty well gone now, 20 years later.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to ride with nomads, help them set up their gear, yurt, sit around in the evening and talk, sing songs, get drunk on fermented horse milk.
Well, that's what I did last night, so that's not a big deal.
Wake up in the morning after a snowfall, and everything, all the trees are just blanketed, the large. And I've said so many times, I have never felt so alive as I have right here. I don't give a hang. In fact, I even commented, I said, if we ride back and it's all gone, it's fine with me.
There you go. We're talking with Dr. William Forsten. He is the New York Times best-selling author of 48 Hours and a bunch of other books. And one of the characters in here was really interesting. Now, again, I've been reading this over a period of 3 weeks since I got the book, and I got podcasts going on and speaking engagements, and I'm doing other projects everywhere. And I'd come back to the book, and I'd pick it up and keep going. And, you know, I may not get an A in this class, Professor, because I was fascinated by the president, but I couldn't find his name. All I kept seeing was president, the president, the president, the president. And so even this morning,
that's deliberate.
Say again? You did.
That was deliberate.
I didn't see his. I got an A. There is no name.
Yes.
Aha! Fantastic. Because I went through for an hour going, where's this guy's name? And I realized there's no name for the president.
A name could give away ethnicity, any number of things. And I actually wrote a book where the president is something of a hero. He's a role model. He's somebody we can trust. A fantasy, let's call it.
Right. But let me just say this, because I made this note. First of all, thanks. I'm glad I didn't miss the president's name. I literally went page by page going, where's this guy's name? So I feel much better about that. Number two, it seems that the president, who shall not be named, is this moral compass. He is this this religious reflector. He is this spiritual warrior. He's got all these profound questions and comments and concepts that he's interjecting at the most difficult of times. Okay. And I'm reading this going, okay, we got past, there's no name, and it doesn't matter. Then all of a sudden you're 100% right. I didn't have an image of him at all. He was this distended voice that was coming in from the left field, proposing and supposing and imposing things that people should have been thinking about at that time that had nothing to do with the solar flares or anything else going on or all the military stuff that would be the normal part of this. He was like, and I'm just going to say it, like the voice of the Almighty. Not literally, but that's what I'm thinking is that where we were headed for this? We should be listening and looking at these questions, not this other stuff?
It was really, writing that character was a pleasure. You know, maybe he's a bit bigger than life, but I think we would need somebody a bit bigger than life if we were all down to 2 days.
And I kept thinking that what I'm being asked by the president who was not named, that I should be considering this stuff today if I haven't, and I do quite often. And number two, I should be doing, I should not just consider this, Bill. I should be living this now. So if by chance or when a cataclysmic event occurs, and even if we do have 48 hours, at least we don't come down to the end of our days going, I shoulda.
Have you ever seen a performance of Our Town?
Oh, I have.
Thornton Wilder.
I have, yeah.
Yeah. I first saw that play when I was about 15 or 16. It blew me away. It has blown me away ever since. I think the best performance you can obtain on video is the one with Newman, Paul Newman.
Mm-hmm.
I got to play the stage manager for our college play 3 years ago. I read the ending of that play to my students every year. And if people listening have not seen or heard of Our Town, turn the show off for 30 seconds because I'm going to give you the spoiler. At the very end, Emily dies. All right. And that's where the scene opens, Act Three. I've always seen the stage manager as God. That he's a representation of God. He guides the story along. An incredibly painful scene is at the very end. Emily is about to leave Earth, and she says, can I just go back and look one more time?
Oh, yeah.
And then she finally says she wants to see the day she fell in love with George and Mary. He says, no, take a simple day. And she finally said, how about my one of my birthdays? I'm getting a chill down my back just remembering it because she gets to watch herself and she then turns to God and she said, people were so oblivious. All of the wonderful things of life that we took for granted, the smell of bacon and eggs cooking in the morning, my warm flannel blanket, my tree out front. Yeah, and then she cries out, oh, Earth, you are so beautiful. Mm. And then she turns to God, and she says, do people ever, ever know how wonderful life is while they're still alive? And he shakes his head, goes, no, saints and poets, they do sometimes. And my closing line to my classes are, go out there and be a saint and poet today. Take a look around at your world and just how wonderful it is. When I played the role, it was difficult because the young lady playing Emily is a student of mine. She just looked so wonderful in what had been her wedding dress.
Hmm.
If I looked into her eyes, I broke down crying at that moment.
Well, you know, I'm envisioning this as
terrible.
I'm envisioning this as you're saying it, and without you may probably not knowing it because of the amount of interviews you do. This whole podcast, Life 2.0 podcast, is based on exactly what you just said. Most of our lives, you know, look, I did a couple of TED Talks, and the second TED Talk I did was called Human Math. My best grades in school were lunch and gym, right? So why is a guy like me doing a TED Talk about human math? And I realized many, many years ago that I was taught a linear way of learning because, you know, everything's in a straight line. You go to the classroom and you sit in a straight row, and everything's in a line for us. We drive in straight lines, what have you. And I learned my multiplication tables in probably second or third grade. And everybody on the planet knows 12 times 12 is 144. I could go to Boise or Boston. It's the same answer. Or Bangkok. It's all the same. And yet I started to realize that my linear mind had gotten so developed that my human math, which does never add up, I was having a hard time when somebody that I thought should live longer didn't. Or when I thought something should go a certain way because it always did before didn't. And so I started digging into the whole thing of human math, and that starting asking those bigger questions changed my life. So, you know, the average lifespan in this country is about 77 and a half, 78 years, and that's like 28,000 some odd days to be alive. And when you look at it that way, it's not very long. But we think it's long because of the line that we've been fed to some degree that, you know, you're gonna hit that average thing. And there's a difference, in my opinion, between having life expectancy and above life experience. And I think what you're writing about in this book is the latter, that it's 48 hours now. The clock is ticking. And when you talked about, you know, Our Town and turning and looking at the creator and saying, what does it take to get it? That was after all the pages I read in your book and went through the whole thing, you summed it up perfectly, because that's what I came away with. The plots are great. The characters are great. You know, the conversation's great, and it's great. That's all great. But I came away with the same thing going, this isn't, it's science fiction, but it's real. And I think that was the best tribute I can pay to your work.
Wow. Wow.
So now that I got you on that, now that I got you on
No, that was my goal.
Yeah.
And for some people it worked, some people it hasn't. If you look at the reviews,
hey, listen,
it's like a reverse. Hey, listen. It's a reverse bell-shaped curve.
Listen, let me just tell you this. So I've written a couple books myself, nothing like what you do. I go in a totally different direction, but I know what it takes to get published. The first two books, I had a 2-book deal, and you know, 98% of manuscripts end up in a garbage dump somewhere, and you know, I get all that. So, but to me, the basics of it are the same. Sitting down and it's going to lead me into what we're going to talk about here in a second about writing what you know and how important it is, I think, as an author. But I also realized when I would write a book and it'd be on Amazon and somebody didn't like it, I thought, I'll tell you what, when you write your book, you send it to me. Because most of the reviews that come in are not from people who write books because we're too smart to... Absolutely. I would never go, this is a piece of crap. Because I know what it takes to pull this off. So when I see those negative reviews, I'm like, I'll tell you what, if you didn't think it was written well, when you're done with your novel, you send it to me.
You right? Go write something.
That's right. That's right. But listen, let's roll into this, because I told you before we got on the air that as great as the book is, and we're talking about 48 hours, the sun erupts, time is running out, humanity faces its ultimate nightmare. By William Fortune. It's out on bookshelves now, and there are still bookstores actually that have these, which is pretty cool.
Yep.
But the afterword just went through me, and in some ways touching to me, about your encounter with one of your own heroes and legends who wrote The Christmas Story. When I read this, I told you, this grabbed me almost more than the book did.
Where did you grow up?
Chicago.
Chicago. Okay. I don't think Gene was being broadcast.
No, he didn't get this far. But everybody knew who he was. Yeah.
Gene Shepherd, back in the 50s and the 60s, broadcast out of New York, WOR, 7:10 a.m. And he'd be on like around 10 o'clock at night. And it became a ritual of my dad, who I call the old man because the way Gene referred to it, that at times, Dad would let me sit up, and he'd pour me like a little 4 to 6 ounce glass of beer and make a sandwich for me, and we'd sit there and listen to Gene and laugh our butts off, all right? Gene was, he is the definition of a ranketeer.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I moved and such, and Gene did have a couple of PBS television shows, one of them called Shepherd's Pie.
Right.
And I read all his books, and he was my hero in terms of being a writer, because Gene Shepherd was writing about a working man's world.
Well, you know, he was born in Chicago, Gene Shepherd.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I say, yeah, he brings that blue collar, bring your lunch bucket deal to work. Yeah.
And that's the world I grew up in. And then it happened. You know?
Yeah.
I go to Maine. I finally get slightly ahead financially. We build a house down by a lake. And then I'm watching that. About a week or two after we moved into the house, one of his TV programs came on, and he was doing a wonderful jab about driving from New York to Maine and all the wonderful tacky places you can stop off at. Gene could do a whole show about an ashtray made to look like a moose, you know, and comparing it to New Jersey. And the last scene in it, he's like, I know that road.
Yeah.
Now, this can't be true. This can't be true.
Yeah.
And I go and check, and sure enough, it's Gene Shepherd. And I go over, take a peek at the property the next day, and a car is parked there with a Jersey license plate. I've just published my first novel. I have an excuse to go up and knock on the door. I do. His wife opened the door, took one look at me, bug-eyed. I never heard of him. I don't know who it is. And I managed to sort of like put my foot in the door slightly. Say, well, I'm your new neighbor. I just built the house down there. I've always admired it. You know, I'm sorry. I thought Jean Shepherd, my favorite author, lived here. Handed her the book. And I start to walk away. And then I hear that very distinctive voice of his go, hey, kid, come on back here. You know?
What a thrill.
We sat and talked for a couple hours. And I've read people saying Jean Shepherd could be a lousy curmudgeon, be rude and everything else. He was absolutely gracious to me. And the key piece of advice towards the end was, why are you writing this science fiction stuff? Write what you know. And that was always in the back of my mind, and I fell into it at last when I was writing the book One Second After, when I said it in my hometown and the college I worked at. Every place I describe in that book series is real. The people are real. It became the easiest thing in the world to write, and I could get deeper into the personalities. And the same thing to a certain extent with 48 Hours. Write what you know.
Was your
I've always been grateful.
Was your pop still alive when that happened or no?
When I met Gene?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was?
Yeah, he was.
What did he say?
Yeah. Oh, he was freaked. Did you kind of meet him? I thought, Dad, my father would have talked his ear off. But Dad was just thrilled that I actually got to meet Gene Shepherd, and I had my books autographed and everything else.
That's fantastic.
My dad was a talker. If he took the word I out of his lexicon, he'd be struck dumb at times. He was, and indeed, a great father.
The last question I ask everybody, with no prep ahead of time, what's the big aha for Bill Forshin after all this time as an author, as a father, as a mainlander, as a neighbor, and all the roads you've traveled? What's your big aha at this point in your life?
Just how miraculous it all is. You know, people have done mathematical equations of what's the probability of this reality happening here. And you're suddenly into the one in the billions because there's so many factors, the type of sun, where the earth is, et cetera. And I'm 68 years old and I'm stunned by how quickly time passes. But every day I try to grab a saints and poets moment. Of observing something, seeing it and going, you know, that's really incredible. And I don't have that happen every day, but it does. I think that's my big aha.
That's a good aha.
That we're going, most of us go through life in a daze. You know, I spoke at a graduation once, and nobody remembers their graduation speakers. And usually they go on too long. The kids want to get out. I make it a point when I give a speech like that, I set a timer for 10 minutes. And I say, when this thing dings, I'm done. I usually get an ovation. And, you know, you start off with, this is an incredible, wonderful day. But I want you all to realize there will come a day 50 years from now. And it will come awfully quick when you will look back at this moment, and you'd give almost everything you own to be able to come back to this moment just for one day. So soak it up in every way possible. Now, I lost both my parents 12, 14 years ago, and I don't know how many times I thought, God, what I would give to be able to sit down with Mom and Dad and say, look what happened. Look what happened after you left. And I guess that's my big aha.
The list of environmental challenges can be overwhelming, but there are solutions to the problems we face. I'm Bill Curtis.
I'm John St. Augustine. Bill and I look forward to seeing you at Earth Matters, a 90-minute multimedia event
on Monday, April 15th at Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago.
The doors open at 6:30 p.m. Admission is free, so spend the evening with us. Monday, April 15th, 6:30 p.m., NEIU Auditorium, 5500 North St. Louis Avenue in Chicago.
Because Earth Matters.